Picture this scenario. You're planning on getting your workout in when everything is right. It's 57 degrees, mostly sunny, no wind, and you're having a perfect hair day. Everything else in your schedule's been checked off, and the world is right for you to now do your workout. Well, that's one way of looking at it, but here's another one that I'd like to suggest. Instead of working out or waiting to work out when everything is right, go ahead and work out to make everything right in your world, or at least a significant part of it. And that's what I want to get into today, guys. Hello, by the way, John Zombro here at the Lifetime Athlete Podcast. This is episode number 223, and I'm going to call the title Empowering People Towards Success, including myself. And where this comes from, or where this, today's episode comes from, it's kind of one of my R3 or R cubed rant, rave, and ramble style of solo-sodes. But this episode specifically comes from a great interaction I just had with someone who means a lot to me, a fellow clinician, a colleague, a great friend and extended family member. That's Danae Snyder. And Danae and I got together to trade our expertises and do some actual work. But also, usually when that happens, we have these stimulating conversations about numbers of topics, but particularly in the fields that we work. And so lifetime athletes are always striving, or hopefully are, for these bigger things. And those are the obvious things. They're the achievement of goals, the attainment of those things, but also health and longevity and living a life of joy. And I think that's what everyone so richly deserves. In fact, I'm going to say this as we're talking about success and projects that we're working on. I'm going to say that there is no perfect, even though we might sometimes be striving for a vision of perfection. There really is no perfect, but in my language, pretty good is often good enough, or fairly close is doggone good enough, however you want to say that. I think, again, when we look at consistency and effort and intention, that's where we get success. And so what I'm going to talk about today is an interesting one, or unique way of framing up today's chat, because I'm going to share, with her permission, Danae's case and what I was contributing to her journey, and also what she has been doing for me with respect to my rehabilitation program with my shoulder. Prior to getting into that, however, I'm going to share some of the things that Danae and I spoke of, and really these wrap around trying to help people to succeed, especially when you're in a service or helping profession. Now, the first thing I would say is we all get by with a little help from our friends. And so in these caregiving professions, sure, we have these professional boundaries to our relationships, but the relationships oftentimes are deeper than just being merely transactional or militaristic, that we don't seem to get the best results when we're trying to coach or provide any type of therapeutic service to a person. We have to relate on a friendly level, if not even more so. And so that's kind of where I'm gonna start. And it's an interesting one in just trying to shape this esoteric theme. But if you think of all the people that you've ever worked with in any number of capacities, but particularly in healthcare, the relationship didn't necessarily have to be, I can use the word intimate and not, use every definition of it, but I think you guys know what I mean. But the relationships that worked the best, that were most empowering, were indeed friendly. They weren't adversarial or confrontational for the most part. And so in thinking of this, Danae and I started off looking at the intricacies of motivation. And it really is a challenge for so many people to do any number of things. And if I stay in this whole idea of training and getting your workouts in and being relatively consistent with your lifestyle, your health habits, your nutrition, obviously that's my wheelhouse. And so that's typically where I like to reside. Well, I have sensitivity for anyone who is struggling and can't seem to overcome the inertia and gain that momentum and get that ball of excellence rolling. And so many times we use strategies when I'm working with clients, and certainly Danae had talked about doing the same, where we try to make things simple, first of all, so that the number of choices that any of us has available, whether that's in our exercise programming or in our diet, for example, is the number of choices is reasonably small. It's easy to make a selection from among two or several items, but it's very difficult if there are 20 things in front of us and we've got to pick the one to get going. So we try to lower decision-making fatigue. Another thing that I've alluded to quite a bit, and many others do as well, is the habitual nature of patterns of excellence. So in other words, making your training, like I call toothbrush training, or a habit like brushing your teeth. When you start to create these habits, then they become automatic and you don't have to use a lot of cognitive energy, mental focus, quote unquote, willpower, whether you believe that exists or not, to get going with things, or just things you do and then you reap the rewards from them. I've also talked a lot about with training how if we can get to the point where we look forward to our workouts and we richly enjoy the process of being active and vital and being a beastly human, we can get past that point where, oh, I'm dreading this thing, I hate it, I just want to get it over with, and then when I'm done, I'll somehow feel good about that or good about myself. I think that higher level is really engaging in the living of life and movement and training and feeling deep down the vibrance and the zest of all of that. So, Danae and I went along and we talked a bit more about these motivational issues and trying to help and guide people in directions where they can then get some of their behaviors automatic and more successful. But the other thing we talked about is, well, what's your ideal client? You know, if you're picking, who do you want to work with? And she'd offered up some things as did I in this conversation, and we generally agreed. So first of all, I think the ideal client in any therapeutic, as in say physical therapy, massage therapy, pain relief, or coaching, which can include those things, or as well as we're working on sports goals or body composition or whatever. Well, the first thing the ideal client probably needs to have, or makes our work easier and better, is this holistic view of health and life and performance, and kind of a comprehensive approach as opposed to being narrow or singular. And this gets into the whole thing where, if you're not sleeping well, your dietary habits won't be quite as effective, especially with regards to body comp. If you're not sleeping well, your recovery's not going to be as good. Your training might not stick. You can flip that around the other way as well and say, well, if you're not eating well, again, you're not fueling your training aspirations and you're not optimizing your health and hormonal balance for that sleep. And you can kind of go back and forth. But the people that really start to get it, get the big picture, that performance is a part of training and recovery, but it's built on a foundation of health. And that's really supported by just simple lifelong habits, just basic movement, good diet, good sleep, good relationships, sunshine exposure, all of those things that I talk about a lot here and that we all know about. But that's what an ideal client is, someone who really buys in, and then all of a sudden they're 10Xing. The results really start happening. You can make little changes in a training program or identify an exercise or two, and all of a sudden, wow, you're getting responses from that. Whereas in the person who's sleep deprived, exhausted, malnourished, stressed, etc., you don't often see much change. And so that's that first thing about an ideal client, someone who has that greater holistic worldview. The next thing is I'm very much a stickler about this these days. You know, I've gotten older, I've gotten more clear on what it is that I can do and what I want to do. And so I only work with people who want to be in a partnership, that we want to work together towards a common goal. And it's usually the goals that they set forth, of course. But, you know, we have to work together. We have to have that team aspect. It's got to be respectful. It's got to have some bounce around. That's where it's going to work. I don't need to be a dictator. It's not my makeup. So I don't do that. And I also, you know, don't really enjoy, and actually I refuse or eventually quit working with anyone who's not participating, not compliant, and I'm not saying perfect, but just engaged in the process. That's really what we need. And the next thing we talked about in an ideal client, or really creating the ideal client-clinician relationship, client-coach relationship, is someone who really views the whole experience as very active, not passive. And that relates to the previous thing, but active to me, and I think to everyone probably who's listening, really means you are into what's going on. You want to learn, you want to grow, you want to apply, you want to question. And that's the whole process, where if it's passive, it's like, don't tell me anything. I don't want to know. Just do these things to me or for me, but not with me. Well, that doesn't work so well. And I don't even get into that kind of work anymore. I know it's not going to be successful. I don't enjoy that. In fact, interestingly enough, however I've designed what I'm doing with my marketing and whatever filters exist, I don't get people who are like that. You know, the Debbie Downers, the negative Nancys, the lazy Larrys. Okay, I'm done with making those statements. But yeah, not that I don't care about everybody. I do. But I realized a long time ago, you know, I can only present information a few different ways, you know, based on, you know, who I am. And sometimes what people need is they just need to hear the message differently. So I've kind of grown from saying, you know, that these people suck, because they don't. And it's not even that my presentation necessarily sucked. It's just that it's just not the best fit. And that's kind of how we want to have this friendly umbrella over everything. In fact, that's the next topic that Danae and I were discussing, is what about when relationships don't work? They don't fit. Well, firing is kind of a fun word to use. It's kind of a power word. Oh, you know, I fired that client, or they fired me. You know, sometimes that actually does happen. But in reality, what we want to do is if somehow the filters didn't work, and then we get into a relationship that's just not a good fit, then one or both of us needs to realize, hey, this isn't the best fit. Let's move on, but let me help you in a way where I can refer or make a recommendation. This might be a better consideration for you and your needs, because my area just isn't quite gonna do it for you. Or, you know, and a nice way to say that, you know, you're just not the kind of person that responds best to how I'm doing things. You get the picture there. So we want to do that when relationships don't work, and help people to move on, move forward, move up. You know, I often like to say to some folks, I'm going to do everything I can to bring you up, but I'm not going to let you bring me down. And, you know, that's just how I roll, but I want to empower folks whenever that's possible. And if the relationship's not working, try to find a way to part amicably. You know, we don't need to go through this life making too many enemies. And, you know, despite all the, you know, the cute talk that's out there, that's where my heart's at. So then, because Danae and I, we've worked together and in collegial circumstances for quite a while now, and we both perform manual therapy as part of what we do in different contexts. We talked about that a little bit, and it's really interesting when you look at the value of manual therapy, or at least the perceived value in some of the circles in healthcare, physical therapy, massage therapy, strength and conditioning, physical preparation, whatever. People have opinions, and sometimes the camps will get very lemming-like, headed for a cliff, actually, or sheep-like, and just follow along without thinking as much as possible. And that's really a disease process in society we've got to watch out for. But back to the value of manual therapy and the pendulum swing, you know, I've seen now over almost four decades the pendulum swing a couple of times in each direction. In other words, that manual therapy is awesome, super valuable, incredibly necessary, and an essential. And then also that it's really none of those things, and we almost don't even need it. Obviously, this gets into some of my thinking about when you're communicating with people or even framing your own mindset, be careful using the words always and never, because everything is context dependent. But back to that thinking about manual therapy, it's a powerful tool, and it does have a place. And this is coming from someone who's done a lot of it, but whose job now is over 80%. Virtual or online. I do most of my therapeutic work, my coaching and consulting across a screen, primarily through Zoom meetings and, you know, also on the phone and using a lot of email. It works great. It works great for most things. But I also do a little bit of concierge work. I'll never let that go away, where, you know, I do have hands-on and I use those skills. I will say this, that there is a skill one can develop in assessing movement in another human's body and tissue qualities. You can do most of that without ever laying on the hands, interestingly enough. But again, the hands are good. But when you get to the point where you have tissues that have issues, right? The tissues that are restricted in some way, and you can either A, temporarily change or alter the circulation and sensation in that tissue, that's good. But sometimes you can actually make mechanical changes in the capacity for that body to move. And that's where I think manual therapy has such a great benefit. And some of that can be turned into like self-mobilization techniques where, you know, maybe all you really need to do is figure out what's needed, how to do it, use the foam roller, use a lacrosse ball, any of those things. Yeah, a lot of times that is good. But there are a few circumstances where you just can't quite get to it that way, or your body's just not, one side's not working to manipulate an object if that's necessary. And so you need this professional who can get in there and do some work. But here's the thing that I learned a long time ago, taught to me by Professor Hansen. Shout out to you, Paul. You're awesome if you're listening. Doubt that you are, but actually, I shouldn't say that. But you know, one of the things Paul taught me, and it always rang true, was what you do in any therapeutic or clinical application, but particularly in manual therapy, is you create the potential or the opportunity for something to move or work better or more naturally or more normally. But unless the individual fairly immediately captures that and uses it and starts to create, let's say, a different normal resting length for muscle or a different extensibility of collagen tissue, reset the CNS to acquire a new motor program. You've got to do that or your manual therapy isn't quite as effective. And so if you get caught in that symptom treating loop where it's like, wait till things get bad, go get some symptom relief, but don't do the quote-unquote correctives to treat the root cause of movement dysfunction, it isn't as valuable then. So I think we need to use it like any tool, manual therapy that is, in our toolbox. Use it appropriately, use it judiciously, use it effectively. And that's where I kind of want to offer up some thoughts to some of my colleagues, therapists, trainers alike, who are out there. And, you know, in some of my mentorship work, when I do a mentorship consultation, you know, this will come up. And it's really like right now, movement patterning and integration with gait and breathing is really hot. And it's good. Now, I'm going to say, I've been doing that for 30 years. It's really not new. But I do think there's some thought leaders who are bringing some things forward. But what I see in some of the young guns is that they don't quite have enough experience to be so confident that that's the only thing. And so what I'm going to say is that when you have tissues that have been traumatized, injured, there's been surgery, or you really have some bad movement dysfunction, whether that's from long-term postural issues or patterns, no amount of biomechanics education alone, or you know, or breathing, or focus is going to totally address the restriction. You have to get in there and work the tissue a bit, and then rebuild from there. And so it's fairly simple, it's fairly obvious, but again, I think people get a little bit argumentative in their camps. I also see that as just a process of maturation. So I'm not too quick to judge, and I'm ready to forgive, but also I think we've just got to have the growth mindset. And so, okay, now moving along. Another area that I mentioned I was going to talk about was what I'm working on and what Danae's working on. And so, you know, just kind of generally, I've been working with this shoulder. Now, I had some congenital issues. I had some injuries. I had a total reconstruction, which included some bone grafting, some tendon transfers or tenodesis procedures, a joint replacement, a number of things, pretty big. You know, if you wanted to pick things, it was one of the bigger or more complex orthopedic surgeries, you know, a person can select. And so, or I guess that got selected for me. But nonetheless, I've recovered from the surgery. Now I'm in this rehab. I've talked about that, trying to transition into training. And one of the things where, you know, Danae really noticed and talked to me about was that my shoulder girdle is glued down. It's locked down. And you know, I'm aware of that. I knew that was going to happen. And part of the reason was because I had some different types of procedures and repairs in there where I had to let it heal and get solidified to some extent. So you're always dancing that dance in rehab with how much early motion can you get in to minimize this glue down, lockdown, stiffening and scarring. But also, you have to let things heal, because if you are a little too aggressive early in a case like this, you can tear things or create laxity and then ruin your outcome at the very least, and possibly even require more intervention, which most of us want to avoid. So that's kind of where I've been. You know, now I'm really getting to the point where I'm pretty safe to do just about anything I want in the gym as long as it's progressive, but I've got to restore more range of motion. You know, I'm going to say in a passive way, you know, there's 20-25% more motion I need to gain, and actively, you know, almost double that right now. But that's where I needed Danae's help. So here's where my story comes, full circle. She did some work with me where we looked at the mobility of the scapula on the rib cage, and you know, we've got 20 some muscles if you start adding it all up that operate on that total shoulder girdle. Not all of them were dysfunctional in my case, but let's just say several were significantly so, and most were moderately so. So she helped me with that, as well as some other tissues, in the joint capsule muscles, etc., through the shoulder, down the arm. Well, as soon as we got finished with that, I did some exercises, not a ton, but enough to, again, make those gains more permanent and lock them in and not let them fade away and drift out of the picture and be so transient. And now, several days later, wow, you know, I feel huge, made a nice leap, you know. And so a couple more rounds of that, and then I'll have gotten most of what I need out of that type of intervention, thanks to Danae's expertise. And so that kind of sums up how I needed help from a friend, first of all, how manual therapy works. And it's really gratifying to, you know, be able to, you know, work with someone and discuss it and realize what she's doing and what my job is coming out of that. And so I think there's probably some pearls for anyone who's having or going to have these types of therapeutic experiences. Now, talking about Danae's case a little bit, and she gave me permission to discuss this, it's a really interesting one because she is a fit lifetime athlete and has, you know, she's always been in good condition and, you know, it's just been very capable, very athletic, very healthy. But as you go through the lifespan, well, things happen. So currently she's a member of the training tribe. So she does balanced training in the five capacities of strength, speed, power, agility, and endurance on our annual training plan. So that's throughout the year. She receives the online programming and then follows through with it. So that's great. She's also a runner. Likes to run, runs for multiple reasons, as most runners do, fitness, performance, thinking time, stress reduction, etc. That's one of the great things of any sporting activity or pastime, essentially. But she does that, but she's also experienced recently with a very gentle escalation of running training, some bilateral knee pain. So Danae's also a member of our Running Demons, and that's a subgroup within the training tribe. It's a running club, and the demons don't run away from their demons. They run with their demons, but they also get some non-demonic coaching from me as a part of that process. Well, we've just been working most recently on aerobic-based development, low intensity, establishing some consistency, starting to touch on gait mechanics, foot strike, etc. Well, as we've been doing that, Danae's developed this bilateral knee pain. It's a little bit more to the lateral aspect of the right knee and a bit more centralized infrapatellar discomfort on the left. And so, you know, you can go through all of your clinical tests or even other diagnostics you can get, you know, get the results from or pursue that, and then come up with these labels, these diagnostic terms. That's fine. You can do that. And I can certainly offer up some of the things that we found in Danae's case. But what we really started to sleuth on is, well, okay, why are you having these problems? And I think that's the big one, you know, because that leads us to root cause. Then we can apply whatever it is that we want to do to ameliorate the situation. And so that's where you get back to that term, corrective exercise, whether you love the term or not. But I do think it has a place. So, you know, this lateral knee pain, you know, we're looking at it and we're saying, well, you know, some of the presentation is sort of like a distal iliotibial band friction syndrome. Yes, it is. Okay. So, okay. No. She does report that a bit of foam rolling sometimes helps those symptoms, but there's also a presence of discomfort that's more intra-articular. It's in the joint. It's in the lateral compartment. The knee's not happy in there. You know, we're not noticing any overt signs of a full-blown meniscus tear or advanced osteoarthritic change or anything like that, but the knee's not happy. And certainly there's loading going through there and wear and tear that's just not ideal. And then we kind of looked at the other side and said, well, okay, most of that discomfort is, retropatellar or infrapatellar in nature. That's the patellofemoral pain condition, which exists. And I think these days the nomenclature is trying to get away from the term syndrome. I'm fine with that. And so chickens and eggs, you know, do both knees have a problem? Is one side contributing to the other? You know, honest answer, I don't know. How can anybody prove all of this? But you can come up with some really good hypotheses. And our hypothesis goes all the way back well over a decade, to my knowledge. I think it's closer to 15 years. Danae's an avid climber as well, and she took a fall, kind of a belaying mishap, and landed hard on that right foot. So we looked at the right foot, and we said, well, okay, passively table tests, it's pretty much normal, although there's a little bit of stiffness in the rear foot at the calcaneal articulation with the talus and also at the talonavicular joint. No quiz here, but basically we're just looking at the heel and the arch, and we're noticing it's the motion's almost within normal limits, but it's certainly not supple and fluid and quite as good as is the left side. So, okay, there's a restriction there. Let's take a look at how you function in stance and gait. And so we kind of looked at a few, you know, stand still, stand on one leg, relaxed versus not relaxed standing, some walking, split stance, you know, just get some data. And so having done that, we basically determined, there is a difference in pronatory function in the feet. The right foot technically underpronates, and the left foot, it's pretty doggone normal. You know, Danae has fairly high arches, which are not rigid, but they're not hypermobile anyway. So that's sometimes called a pes cavus foot. Well, what we started to really figure out was she is not really getting enough pronation to access the inside edge for push-off on that right foot. And so if I explain that a little bit more clearly, I like to view the foot oftentimes as a tripod. The heel is one point of contact, and then you've got outside ball, inside ball. Those are your fifth metatarsal and first metatarsal heads, respectively. So that's how we bear weight in our foot. We use those points of contact, and it varies depending on what we're doing in the phases of gait and the stance cycles. So, so what we noticed in Danae is she's making an appropriate lateral contact on the foot on the right, and so all that means is that she's landing on a supinated foot on the outside of the foot, which we're supposed to do with walking. It's more of an overt heel strike, and with most running, it should be, in my opinion, somewhat of a midfoot strike. So we see that she's doing that, but what we don't see is she's not getting that line of force transference or progression to be able to push off the big toe side. She's really just pushing off the fifth med head or the outside ball. And doing that then travels up the chain. So you can say, well, what exactly is happening? Well, it's affecting how forces go up the leg, and of course, in this case, to the knee. So a couple things are happening. First of all, when we do that, we don't get the same amount of tibial internal rotation, or the turning in of the shin, that the natural pronation will drive. And so it's like, you're not moving force across the tissues in the way that you were designed or born to do. This injury has developed probably more of a compensatory pattern, almost that goes back to pain and guarding than true restriction, interestingly enough. But both do exist. So we're saying, okay, well, that's not happening. So when that happens, we increase the load in the lateral compartment of the knee. And at the very same time, that absence of pronation, which is known as a torque conversion mechanism, among other things, dissipates some force. We're actually throwing more ground reaction force. So we've got basically a latency of, well, not necessarily a latency, but a prolonged nature of loading in this lateral aspect of the knee. So all the tissues are like, we don't quite like having this force as long as it's lasting, and it's coming up a little stronger because it's not being dissipated. So we're like, that's probably what's affecting your knee. Then we look left and we say, because of that, there's a little bit of asymmetry, in the gait cycle. It's like, we're seeing the weight shift over to the left side a few milliseconds. I don't have the device to time that, but a bit sooner. So we're loading the left knee in compensation for this right, and they're both getting peeved, which is not uncommon for tissues to do. So if I go back, I left something out when she had that fall. No x-rays were taken, and not sure if there was a fracture somewhere or not. It's healed. Again, it's healed fairly good, a little bit stiff. But so when we kind of talked about it, that's where we came up with that. You do have some restriction there, but it's not rigid. But also you have this pattern, you've developed this habit where we may be able to retrain the body. So we came up with all of this in, kind of a quick exam. And then we said, well, what are we going to do? How are we going to approach this? And years ago, I might have been really eager at first to design an orthotic that was going to try to change those foot mechanics, move the forces around, alter things at the foot. That still might be something we look at down the road, but these days I'm thinking if we can really find things that are trainable, let's train those first. In Danae's case, she's very, very trainable. So I thought to myself, you know, I'm kind of, you can't have a cookbook. You have to come up with these things based on the presentation in front of you. I said, well, we actually can help you to increase mobility in this rear foot mechanic and midfoot as well. And so we used a wedge, and I've got a little foam wedge that I use. And so we placed that wedge. So the wedge is coming under the heel and arch from the outside. So it basically tips or facilitates the rolling in, aka pronation, of the foot. So we're getting quite a bit of calcaneal eversion as well as stretching some of those tissues. Now, I thought, well, here's how you do it. You just stand on it with most of your body weight on that side and create a prolonged stretch. Superincumbent body weight is going to be active. You don't have to bounce and, you know, jump around. The clinical efficacy of various manipulation techniques for these things is not that good. So I thought, hey, this is really one of the better interventions you can do. It takes 1 or 2 minutes. Do it every workout. And the idea there, that's what's known as a low load prolonged duration stretch. And that's what collagen fibers benefit from. They undergo gentle deformation, sometimes called ligamentous creep. But nonetheless, we can improve that pronation ability in the right foot. Don't do it on the left. Left doesn't need it. That's a trap a lot of people fall into. Should I always do all my exercises on both sides of the body? You fix what needs fixing, and if one side's good, maybe not. So I said, okay, we want to add this in. And I'm like, well, okay, now what's the next level? If we create some mobility, now let's see if we can just create some more awareness. And so what we know is in walking gait, you know, we're going to load outside heel, and then as we approach toe off, we're going to go to inside ball. That's not straight line. It's kind of a curve or banana shape when you look at force plate studies. But I said, well, okay, let's get you in a split stance and have you get into the bottom of the range so you're getting close to a 90-degree knee bend on that front or right knee. Hold a kettlebell in the left hand so you got your weight opposite the front foot. What that's going to do is the weight's going to pull to midline. That's going to help Danae to access this inside ball a little bit better. She doesn't have to straighten all the way up out of it. She's doing kind of a half-range pulsatile, a couple sets of that, not loading too heavy, training again, more for awareness and repetition than, let's say, you know, massive force, power, muscle development, something like that. So you got that. Another thing I like to do is I like to keep exercise programs simple, you know, in most cases, single-digit numbers total in most cases. I've seen it too many times. You give a person 27 things to do, they do nothing. You give them 3, they get it done most of the time. So I gave her 4, you know, can't resist. So next thing I did was I said, well, let's just look at your squat pattern. You know, that's, you know, it's one of the 7 basic movement patterns. So I like to use it from time to time. I said, well, here you go. You don't have to hit rock bottom in your squat, but we want you doing a squatty squat. It's fairly vertical torso, not so much a hingy deadlift looking squat. So I said, well, let's use a ramp, you know, a heel lift, a board, whatever. Get your heels up in the air, decrease the dorsiflexion demand, increase 4-foot loading. Just feel that same thing upright, going from outside heel to inside ball on the way down. And then that's that point you press off from and head back up. So she was doing that, doing well with those things as far as getting it, you know, and we put this into the program and said, hey, okay, here you've got these 3 movements. You know, maybe you don't have to do them every single day, but, you know, most of your workouts, these should be a part of it. And in the training tribe right now, they're actually doing a strength training phase. So the program is a push, legs, pull, split. So that'd be like ABC workout, Monday's A, Tuesday's B, Wednesday's C, repeat again. Got 1 day off. And the running demons have some other things that they're adding in. So in Danae's case, she's going to have enough opportunities 3 or 4 times a week or so to get that exposure. The last thing that we added, though, was gait training In other words, just thinking about that. And so how I like to do that with cueing with runners is, like, you don't have to concentrate entirely. As you're out running, every once in a while, spend about a minute focusing on feeling that force move through the foot and how it aligns and essentially empowers your leg to do what it's going to do. So just explain that a little bit differently. You know, I said earlier, with walking, we generally do have a fairly definitive heel strike. In most cases, especially if you're on a soft surface, concrete's a little different if you're barefoot. But nonetheless, we have that. But when running, most of the good research will say that we're not going to land on the heel. There's some people that, let's say, are heel striking, and that's a problem. Some of that's a factor of shoe wear. But once we get a person optimized, there's not much heel striking. There are a few people who look like they're doing a soft heel strike, but they quickly roll through it. Some of that, again, is the shoe midsole giving that picture. But when running, we're going to land on the lateral side of the foot. The faster we go, typically the farther forward on the foot that contact point is. And then we're going to push off the inside ball coming out through the big toe. And interestingly enough, not on the inside edge of the big toe, because that would suggest too much pronation or rolling of the foot. The foot's actually kind of stiffening back up in a domino wave fashion. And I've talked about that on the YouTube channel a little bit with pronation and gait. And I've got some new stuff coming out on that if you guys are interested. You can certainly look for it, but you can also ping me, contact me, and I can let you know specifically when those things will be available. But anyway, back to this. I just had today think about that. Think about it for about a minute and then forget and go on a little bit more. And those are the things that she's doing. Now, interestingly enough, only a couple of days have gone by and she's already noted, hey, I think we're onto something. This felt better. You know, I was able to run longer prior to the onset of discomfort. And when it did show up, it was milder. Those are big things. You know, we don't want to be silly and think we're done, but definitely making good progress. And so that's kind of what we did. And I think this just is so fun when you have these opportunities to work with people. And, it feels good in these relationships. Now, having said all that, I'll just kind of go back and say, you know, there's a couple new things that are going to be coming out on the YouTube channel related to some of these concepts in biomechanics that I've been learning about and studying for a very long time, and I've just got evolved some of my models and views, and they're fairly consistent with what's going on, but also they have the uniqueness of my experience, at least I hope. And so, yeah, talking about those gait patterns a little bit and how force plate studies show forces and pressures going through the foot and wave-like phenomena. I'm going to do a video on that, probably fairly short, use the whiteboard, and just get folks a little bit of a better understanding of foot biomechanics or specifically the mechanisms of pronation and supination, just next-level understanding. Then I thought, well, you know, one of the things that's happened so many years for me is folks will say, well, look at my shoes, or what are my shoes saying? So interpreting shoe wear patterns is going to be another quick one that I'm going to do. And I'm going to explain how when you look at an outsole, it shows wear on the outsole. And so you don't want to look at a new shoe somebody has. You want a shoe they've been wearing for a while. Well, you're only going to see two things. You know, you're going to see where initial contact's made and where push-off is, for the most part, on the outsole. And if they walk in it a lot, you're going to see that your lateral heel have some wear, and then you'll see some push off or scuff marks somewhere near the big toe as the shoe's exiting. That's most of what you see. You can travel up into the upper of the shoe and look at, are there tears or stress marks? Is the midsole, does it have fatigue lines or is it compressed? You can do all that, but also the miniature force plate that lies within the shoe, that's the removable sock liner. Again, for people that maybe they haven't replaced it with a custom orthotic or something, you can take that sock liner out and it's going to show what the foot's been doing over time in terms of pressures. And so I'm going to do a video on that. I think that's going to be really cool for folks. You know, again, I think clinicians are going to learn some things from this. And again, that's the mentorship stuff, but also any athlete or runner who wants to do a bit deeper dive self-inquiry is going to gain something. And then you can go to this this next thing that I'm doing, which is taking some of those gait patterns and foot mechanics and helping folks to understand, actually simplify how that now coordinates with breathing, with the movement of the visceral contents and the alignment of the rib cage and the pelvis and diaphragmatic activity and how we have expansion and yielding and versus compression and propulsion. And a lot of those things have been tossed around by some really smart people. But I also, I see people being confused. I see clinicians being confused with some of the mumbo jumbo that they're saying. And I also see a lot of interested athletic folks wanting to know more in a little bit simplified pattern. So I'll kind of try to take that along. In fact, there's going to be some future work that I'm putting out that looks at the new functional exercise, and exercise that doesn't really disrespect all the things in strength and conditioning that we have, but looks at it in a way that's, well, what is truly functional? What do biomechanics say, and how can you both improve your performance and preserve your joints? So this definitely turned into be an R3 rant, rave, and ramble from old Coach Jay-Z. And thank you so, so much for being with me. I wish you a fabulous day. If you need any information about what's going on, just go to thelifetimeathlete.com. You can hit the search menu for hundreds of resources in terms of articles, other podcasts, and videos. You can also look at the services in coaching that I offer online. So thanks again. Catch you next time.